It has been an interesting year, with lots of ups, lots of downs for all of us. What I'm realizing on a personal level is that if I only look at this moment, yes, it can be very grounding as I face into what is happening now, but it also can be very limiting, very short-sighted. I wonder if that's why in the East people think beyond this one lifetime to an expanse of birth and death and rebirth experiences. It is difficult to imagine that all of what we are ends when we die. Maybe reincarnation is a way that we would be more mindful of ensuring the health and condition of the future of this planet if we knew that some essence of us would be coming back. It has always been a part of my practice to stay firmly rooted in this moment. But for some reason, things are changing. Maybe it's because I have a realization of my biological roots, having an understanding of my ancestral story that is changing my awareness that now spans generations. Yes, I am here in this moment, but my DNA, and all of our DNA, has been on a very long, ever-evolving journey. This morning when I checked my email, I realized that I have a fourth bio-cousin who lives in Wollongong, New South Wales, Australia, because he emailed me. Who knew? I have no idea how we're connected at this point, through my bio-father or bio-mother, but it's amazing to think of the journey and the story that separates us one from another. As many of you know, I've been spending some time thinking about my ancestry this year. I grew up with stories from my adopted family, accepting them as my own, a family that told me that I was special because I was chosen by them. And they truly did make me feel very special. But even though I was a chosen child and loved, I always felt a little disconnected because I did not know my story, my family traditions. I did not know the journey that my DNA made to get me here. For me, as one who always wonders, I wanted to know more about that journey. I wanted to know who my people were, and I thought it was fascinating what you could find out when you search through your DNA and connect the dots. Now, Paul Rising reminded me of this, which is it can be an incredibly challenging and misleading and elusive search that can lead you all sorts of places. What I've realized through all of my seeking is that the journey that our DNA takes is massive, and it extends out far beyond what the mind can even fathom. A journey that brings together hundreds and thousands of people migrating and congregating throughout history to make us. Two people created you, created me. Four people created them, eight people created them, 16 and 32, and so on. A DNA tree is a fascinating and expansive construct. What I found, and I continue to find out about my bio mother's ancestry is incredible, and probably something that her family is not even aware of. I've not even begun the journey to uncover the interesting journey through my bio father's line. I think this fourth newly discovered cousin might just be a solid link to follow. Most of us, if we're lucky, know four generations: great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, and children. But what about those who came before? We may know stories that have been passed down, or heirlooms, or traditions that have been a part of one's family for generations. But our bodies, our physical representation, tell a story that is much older. The color of our eyes, our hair, the build of our frame, the shape of our face, the length of our toes or our fingers. Each cell in our body tells a story that connects us to the people who came before us. I remember sitting in my mother's kitchen, listening for hours to her and my aunts tell their stories. And every time they tried to stop, all the cousins being like, no, tell the story when. They were funny and engaging, and they gave my cousins and I context for our beliefs and behaviors. Stories that were lovingly crafted and evolved to seem less harsh, more romantic maybe. We have all of this history and tradition, these grandparents and parents who are still with us, because they are lovingly remembered. Their lives extended in the telling of their stories, forward through the generations. We cannot know those who live generations before us, but we can know of them and of their stories. For those of us who are New Englanders, I didn't know until recently just how New Englandish I really am, until I began this DNA search. There is history, traditions, clues that are left behind in historic recounts, in ship manifests, in town records. One becomes a sleuth discovering this or that possible piece of the story. Maybe it is a story of how one's great-grandparents, grandparents, or parents made the journey of hope to America. This morning, I'd like to start at the beginning. And really, it isn't actually the beginning of the beginning, but the early days of the European, English, Irish, and Scottish immigration to Massachusetts. It is beginning times of this first parish's inception. The story goes that pilgrims fled from religious persecution, and I think that in truth they wanted to create and live in a world that was far from deception, politics, sin, corruption. They wanted to realize the perfect society that was led by their spiritual convictions. The Anglicans, on the other hand, may have sought more freedom, but ultimately they sought adventure, profit, when they came to the New World. The indigenous people of this country, who had been here for a very long time, were inundated by immigrants, bringing foreign ways, disease, and an uncertainty and dislike of difference. To get a sense of the times and culture of the early days, I read a blog on historyofmassachusetts.org, which I thought would be interesting to share with you. Early Boston was a hilly peninsula, originally inhabited by Massachusetts tribe of Native Americans, who had lived in the area since 2400 BCE. The tribe called the area Shaman, and the nearby river, which is now known as the Charles River, the Quinnibiquay, which means long, still water. Massachusetts translates in the indigenous language to at the range of hills. The small peninsula was only 789 acres wide, and consisted of three hills that settlers later named Trimont, Mount Vernon, Beacon Hill, and Pemberton Hill, as well as two other hills they named Copse Hill and Fort Hill. In 1614, explorer Captain John Smith sailed to the Massachusetts Bay and befriended the tribe living in the area. 2 years later, he published a map of the area and named it New England to make it more appealing to English colonists. By 1618, more than two-thirds of the Massachusetts Indians living in the area were wiped out by yellow fever, smallpox brought by the European traders, and only 25,000 indigenous people survived. After a settlement known as George's Colony failed in Weymouth, Massachusetts in 1623, almost all of the colonists returned to England, except one, Reverend William Blackstone. Blackstone, an Anglican clergyman, moved from Weymouth to Shawmut in the area that is now Beacon Hill. This made him the first settler to live in Boston. Blackstone built a cabin near a freshwater spring at what is now the intersection of Charles Street and Beacon Street, and lived isolated and alone. Can you imagine it? He sustained himself by hunting animals and planting the first ever apple orchard in New England from seeds he collected. The Puritans started to arrive in 1630 by the boatful. One of the first waves were from the Winthrop fleet carrying 700 passengers, 200 of which died in the first 6 months of landing here. They sailed into Salem and then on to Charlestown, but could not survive there because of the lack of fresh water, and instead moved over to the peninsula, which they affectionately renamed Boston, after the town they'd left in England. The Puritans, to say the least, were strict in their ways, punishing and banishing people for not adhering to standards of pure conduct. The Puritans continued to expand and took control over everything but the 50 acres of land that Blackstone believed were his. Sick of the religious fervor and strictness now prevalent in the area, Blackstone decided to sell his remaining land to the Puritans, which became Boston Common. And he moved to what is now Rhode Island. Boston and Watertown were settled. Cambridge, then called Newtown, was settled by the Winthrop fleet as they sailed up the Charles River. And among them was my 11th great-grandfather, Edmund Lockwood, his wife Elizabeth, his son Robert, and his daughter Rose. After his death in 1636, he is buried in Cambridge. His widow, my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great, and on and on, grandmother, and their children migrated to New Haven with Reverend Davenport, who ultimately encouraged and secured settlements in Connecticut all along Long Island Sound oceanfront. My people specifically settled in Fairfield, Stamford, and in the Greenwich area of Connecticut. This was the same time in 1638 and 39 that Sudbury was founded and incorporated. Sudbury was the 19th town settled in the Mass Bay Colony and the second from what they called beyond the flow of the tide. I love that. It was bounded by Watertown to the east. Think about this. Watertown to the east. Only later did Weston and Wayland split off and incorporate, and Concord to the north. Sudbury was the boundary beyond which to the west and the south lay vast wilderness. This was one of the few communities described in an account that was representative of all three English traditions, which together formed the heritage of Massachusetts. Salem and Sudbury were the largest communities in the New World. Settlers of Sudbury came from Openfield Village, the incorporated borough, and the closed-form East Anglican Village. This is the one place in the New World which merged the influence of our communal town life, independent farming, borough government, and the experience of English parish churches. So it was like this whole confluence of energy and people with lots of different backgrounds. It was a practice that when a community was settled in New England, one of the first public buildings to be built was the meeting house, a place for government, public meetings, trials, and worship on Sunday. The first parish of Sudbury meeting house was initially built in 1641 on the east side of the Sudbury River. The professional ministry of the first parish of Sudbury began with Reverend Edmund Brown, who was a Puritan Calvinist in his theology. The members that lived on the west side of Sudbury would have to commute a very long distance to attend Sunday worship, all by horse or carriage, and town meetings. It wasn't until 1722 when Reverend Israel Loring accepted the call to be the first minister of the newly created precinct on the west side of Sudbury that a meeting house was built on this site. Reverend Loring was the minister here for 50 years, until 1772, and he never retired. He stayed. Wayland was incorporated soon after Loring died in 1780, with Maynard following suit almost 100 years later, incorporating in 1871. All of these areas and more used to be part of the early Sudbury. The ministry that followed at First Parish was of Calvinist and Trinitarian leaning. In 1825 to 1850, there was a spiritual awakening taking place in New England, including here in Sudbury. It was a time when people, not just Unitarians, were considering the authenticity of their theological teachings. Unitarianism, once a derogatory term, became a choice. Unitarianism was being born as well out of, or Universalism was being born as well out of the Baptist faith, and Transcendental was stepping into the light out of European theological thinking with a splash and dash of Eastern philosophy, and voila. I resonate personally with Transcendentalism, with the primary premise being the inherent goodness of people and nature. Adherents believed that society and its institutions have corrupted the purity of the individual, and they have faith that people are at their best when truly self-reliant and independent. Transcendentalism emphasizes subjective intuition over objective practicality. Adherents believe that individuals are capable of generating completely original insights with as little attention and deference to past masters as possible. Sounds very Unitarian. Ralph Waldo Emerson, a once Unitarian minister, accompanied by many other Unitarian clergy and open-minded thinkers of the time, helped to cultivate this revolution in spiritual thinking within New England congregations. First Parish, probably being somewhat caught up in the fervor, had been calling for pulpit exchanges, which was a common practice at the time. They wanted the Reverend Rufus Hurlburt to invite Unitarian ministers to speak in their pulpit. Being a Trinitarian, he devoutly refused. The more liberal-leaning part of the congregation, including the clerk, took control of the pulpit one Sunday. It was one of his Sundays off. They had invited a Unitarian minister, locking the door, and the Reverend Hurlburt and his speaking proxy for that Sunday were left outside. The rest is history. Reverend Hurlburt, the next week, came to worship, picked up the Bible, walked out the door, a very symbolic act, and down the road, and the portion of the congregation followed him. It was 1850 when the first Unitarian minister was called by First Parish, the Reverend Linus Shaw. And there has been no looking back since. Early on in our inception, it was commonplace that Meeting House be run by the town, and each member of the town paid a tax to the town to support the church. And it was mandatory, as was attendance. Changing times, a new face moving into town, changed the manner in which First Parish was supported. Division of church and state became the law of the land. The minister received housing from the congregation, wood, chickens, cows, some cash, maybe some clothing, and that's how they were paid. The needs of the congregation were pretty small. The building and the grounds were maintained by the members exclusively. As the new world continued to evolve, members paid a pew tax, so you would actually be taxed to sit in the pew that you sit in, and those comfortable seats. That was clearly not a long-term solution. Then there was the idea of supporting the church by tithing, usually 10% of the family's gross income. And finally, well, that didn't work out either. And then finally, there was the idea of pledging and fundraising to support a professional ministry, staff, and building. Believe it or not, we're still trying to figure out ways to support First Parish. The building, the staff, the congregation. We are not the only congregation that struggles with this. We're all trying to sort it out, taking information from each other, trying to help out when we can, but none of us have it quite figured out yet. In 1904, the first parish called a woman minister. 1904. Before we even earned the right to vote, ladies. Reverend Ida C. Hulton, who was a suffragist and a mover and a shaker in Unitarian circles, she was a prominent speaker at the Parliament of World Religions held in Chicago in 1893. And she was your minister here. Reverend Hulton was, as they call it, an ethical basis Unitarian, active in free religious association. She was a person who already defined herself beyond or outside traditional Christianity. So if you wonder where you're getting it from, it's a long-standing tradition. She sometimes talked of a religion of humanity or rational religion. Many of this ilk considered themselves the next generation of transcendentalists. While the ideas are not the same as late 20th century humanism, the development in that direction was well underway in the thought of women and men like Ida Hulton. Reverend Hulton stayed with First Parish for 11 years, but her teachings still resonate within this meeting house. It was the courage of the leadership and the congregation who took a chance in calling an outspoken activist to lead them. It's kind of impressive. After the crash on the stock market in 1929, the town approached First Parish wanting to buy the grounds and the building. That was 1930. The leadership refused. First Parish has evolved over the years. We have had some good times. We have had some lean times. But with the courage and the help of the members and the Women's Alliance, we have kept moving forward with some significant progress. Ministries were longer back in the day, 20-plus years. So were the sermons. A minister was expected to stay with a congregation for 20-plus or more years, and that's a single congregation, and a sermon on Sunday could last all day. Don't worry. Over the years, sermons and ministries have gotten shorter. I wonder if there's any correlation. In reviewing our history, the one thing that has remained consistent over the last 11 or so generations were the members of this congregation. They, you, have been courageous, committed, do-it-yourselfers who challenged convention, were outspoken, and never shirked from a challenge. Every minister that has ever served this parish, standing in this pulpit, I can guarantee, had to know one thing: that a parish is only as adventurous, sustainable, and healthy as the members. You, my friends, are the capable hands of a very long tradition of showing up and caring. The decisions that you make as a community will unfold in ways that we cannot even know, but are sure to resonate for generations of members yet to come, who will arrive seeking solace in this meeting house. Many arriving have sought community, connection, traditions such as the Harvest Fair, weekly worship, a fun-loving, committed community, willing to live on the edge of the wilderness and survive in fine style. All of these many generations later, people are still seeking meaning in both good times and bad and difficult times. Tradition and history is what makes us First Parish. From signing the book to become a member, to our commitment to social justice, to our annual liturgy that is not creed-based, the decisions that were made have informed us and continue to form us. The interesting revelation about this First Parish congregation is that it is ever evolving with incredible members. I think of the Reverend Judy Deutsch, who has given so much of herself, her care, her compassion and passion to our ministry, her commitment to justice. Polly Meltzer, who has given of herself over and over again in small and large ways, and always from her heart. I know that you will bring light to both the congregations that you go to and wherever you roam. I want to just thank you for sharing yourselves with us. We will truly miss you both. I think of the many throughout our history that have been lost to old age, to illness, to tragedy. Each has sculpted this First Parish endeavor with their own hands, their own hearts, their own minds. How hard their hands and mind worked to ensure that this community would stand with integrity, creativity, compassion, mindfulness, and love. Everywhere we look, we see traditions, from coffee mugs to name tags to religious exploration to the decoration of our sanctuary, plain and simple, to holding our annual meeting today after worship, at which time the congregation will courageously vote for our future yet again, in the same fashion that it always has been. One could not have imagined that society in the new world would change so exceptionally over the ensuing 4 centuries since Captain John Smith visited Mass Bay, made friends with the Massachusetts people, and created a map. Our new world has evolved and expanded, and others have joined us, hopeful on this wild adventure. We have been endeavoring generation upon generation to build a beloved community for all. Built on exceptional values, we have all worked together, linked through the generation, arm in arm. This is our most humble and committed quest, our timeless tradition par excellence. We are all in this together. Thus, we carry on. We carry on. I invite us to enter into a time of silent prayer and meditation.